Well, another task force, this one led by Democrat Alice Rivlin and Republican Pete Domenici, is presenting its deficit reduction plan in Washington today, a product of the Bipartisan Policy Center. Rivlin and Domenici go a little further than the proposals outlined last week by President Obama's bipartisan panel, led by Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson. But both panels stress that in addition to lowering the deficit, any plan has to be pro-growth. So, for instance, the Bowles-Simpson plan calls for adding a 15-cent a gallon tax on gas to pay for highway and mass transit projects that would produce jobs. It's a tricky thing, this balancing a budget. You can just yell, off with their heads and cut federal jobs, but what do you add to increase revenue? Maybe take away mortgage tax deductions? How about raising the Social Security age to 70? Wow, look, that would cut $245 billion from the deficit. But wait a minute, will people be able to stay in the workforce till the age of 70? It is a tricky thing. And the New York Times recently threw out this challenge to all of us yammering on the sidelines. Okay, you fix the budget. That was New York Times business columnist David Leonhardt's headline this past Sunday. He and budget experts came up with their online deficit puzzle. You can link at our website, hereandnow.org, or just follow along with us now as we play Cut the Deficit with David Leonhardt. David, welcome.
Thanks for having me back.
And let's explain how it works. You have this big grid. That's the deficit. And you've laid out the options we have under spending and then under revenue. Each option is sort of like a Lego piece, you know, some bigger than others, that you then put on that big grid and just slowly fill it until you've got the right number. And the number you've come up with is $1.4 trillion for the year 2030. That's the deficit you want to cut. Now, why 2030?
We picked 2030. We actually picked 2 years, 2015 and 2030.
Right.
But we picked 2030 as our long-term year because it's far enough out that you're starting to really see the effects of the baby boomers retiring, and particularly so many of them be on Medicare with our rising health care costs. Mm-hmm. But unlike 2050, there are actually a decent number of estimates for the cost of different programs in the year 2030. Typically, the Congressional Budget Office goes 10 years out, but on some things they or the Social Security actuaries will go longer. On other things, we worked individually with budget experts to get 2030 estimates.
Right.
So that's why we picked 2030. There's
right.
nothing magic
right.
about
well,
it.
And a lot of, you know, as you said, baby boomers are going to be hitting some of their services then. But as you said, short-term and long-term deficits. So, for instance, you've got eliminating earmarks or pork as a spending cut. It's a little tiny Lego piece, maybe $14 billion a year. You've got eliminating farm subsidies. That's another sort of little Lego piece, about $15 billion a year. But, you know, we could just throw those on the grid and lop those off. But what are questions that should be asked before you do that?
Well, with any one of these questions, you want to ask what effect it's going to have. So farm subsidies, you mentioned $14 billion. That's about 1%. Earmarks, another $14 billion, another 1%. So if you cut both of those, you've got 2% down and 98% to go. But obviously one of the questions is, well, how do you feel about farm subsidies? Farm subsidies disproportionately go to pretty big agribusinesses, so many people, and I'm certainly among them, thinks they're largely unnecessary. I mean, we don't have subsidies for toy companies, and we don't have subsidies for other kinds of companies, and it seems to me this is a relic from another time. And not only that, but even if in the perfect world maybe we would have some farm subsidies, we don't live in the perfect world. We live in a world in which we have to make real choices. And so you do want to weigh the pros and cons. I think the main pros and cons to weigh are what effect it might have on income inequality, whether you prefer to cut spending or to raise taxes. And then, to me, the biggest one is what kind of an effect this is going to have on economic growth.
Well, let me stop you there, because you
Absolutely.
Say you can't just cut. You've got to have economic growth. You've got to encourage jobs. And you've got a whole bunch of revenue options, like, you know, okay, what kind of estate tax can you pick? Can you maybe exempt maybe the first $5 million of an estate from taxes, but then tax the rest, or maybe exempt the first $1 million of an estate, but then tax the rest? And boy, that would be that, you know, exempting just the first $1 million, that would be $105 billion cut. And again, that's sort of a, you know, you get money coming in, a revenue option. But why is it important to encourage growth?
Because growth can, by itself, help pay down the deficit. The deficits we're now facing are almost certainly too big to be paid off with growth alone. But if you go back to the 1990s, the tax cut that was put in place by Bill Clinton, the tax cut that was put in place before that by George H.W. Bush, which was smaller but still helped, they did reduce the deficit. But when you go back and you look at the numbers, actually, it was the fast economic growth of the late 1990s that reduced the deficit more than anything else. And the story is the same if you look to the 1950s and 60s and see how we paid off our post-war debts, and it's the same when you look to other countries. And so the worst thing we could do is put in place a form of policies that actually reduce economic growth, because then what we'd be doing is, in the course of solving the problem, we would also be making it worse. We want to try to solve the problem and also make it better at the same time.
So you can't just slash and burn. And as we mentioned, one panel suggestion was a 15% tax on gas so that there could be jobs produced that could do things like build roads. Pick another Lego piece, David Leonhardt. Which one would you pick for growth?
Well, I think tax reform is an interesting one to pick, because right now we have this tax code with huge numbers of loopholes and deductions and credits, and we all spend a lot of time filling out our tax forms. Not only that, we spend time doing things in order to qualify for tax breaks. And so if we had a tax code, and both of the two bipartisan plans have come out in favor of an idea along these lines, if we had a tax code that reduced all those deductions and all those loopholes, both for companies and for people, we could lower tax rates and still actually raise money.
Well, I'm looking at the Lego. It's huge, $175 billion to reduce individual and corporate tax breaks, and then another $55 billion, it's not as big, but to reduce mortgage deductions and other high tax breaks for high-income households. Now, a lot of people are screaming about that. You know, that's, for some people, their only deduction. But you say another reason to remove some of these tax breaks is that Americans stop sort of living their lives to qualify for tax breaks.
That's right. What we want people doing is saying, hey, it looks like that's the most efficient way for me to use my time. We want companies doing the same thing. That's the kind of stuff that in the long run leads to innovation, leads to new jobs. If people are running around saying, maybe I should go buy that second vacation home because I will qualify for more tax breaks, that doesn't help economic growth in the long run. Buying that vacation home isn't a productive use of capital. And we now have a lot of that in our tax code. I mean, you'll often hear as a talking point, we have the second highest corporate tax rate in the world, which isn't false, but we have so many deductions that corporate taxes as a share of our economy have fallen really drastically over the last 20 or 30 years. So, in fact, we have this kind of worst of both worlds in which we have a really high tax rate that doesn't actually collect much revenue.
Yeah.
So I think that changing that, which I want to be clear about, that's not the same as a tax cut. Saying that we're going to cut marginal rates and get rid of deductions, that's not a tax cut. If we do that and do it in a way that reduces the average person's tax burden, we're adding to the deficit.
In fact,
but it can lift growth.
In fact, we want to take a look at, for instance, the Bush tax cuts. What would you cut? With David Leonhardt of the New York Times, we're playing his papers deficit puzzle. You can link at our website, hereandnow.org. They've broken down our options into spending options, domestic, foreign spending, military spending. What would you cut? Social Security. And revenue options, taxes, as we've said, investment taxes, new taxes. You know, how about a tax on banks? But would they just pass that along to people who go to the bank? So we'll have more with David Leonhardt. And again, feel free to play along at hereandnow.org. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're taking a shot at solving the federal deficit puzzle today. Good luck to us. With New York Times business columnist David Leonhardt, he writes the paper's economic scene column, and they've come up with this deficit puzzle. It's really a lot of fun. You can see it at our website, hereandnow.org. But essentially, it's sort of a Legos game. Each spending cut or revenue option, you know, way to increase revenue for the government, is sort of like a big Lego piece. And David, on the spending side, I just want to take a quick look at military spending. Boy, the cuts are not that big. You know, the Lego pieces that they represent are not that big until you get down to speed up withdrawal from Iraq and Afghanistan. Boy, that's $170 billion if the withdrawal leaves only 30,000 troops by 2013. That seems to be the biggest cut.
It is. Wars are expensive. And so that gets you, more than 10% of the cuts that you need by 2030. Now, obviously, that comes with a big potential downside. I mean, if you were worried that a more rapid withdrawal from Iraq and Afghanistan makes the world a less secure place, it may not be something you want to do. If, on the other hand, you've now seen these wars going on longer than World War II did, and you feel like things aren't getting any better, then maybe you do want to do it.
Yeah.
The other defense cuts, though, when you add them all up, are also significant. I mean, you can get close to $200 billion in 2030 savings by implementing a series of recommendations from something called the Sustainable Defense Task Force, which was set up by Congress and came out with roughly $100 billion a year in today's terms.
Well, this is canceling some weapons programs like the F-35, reducing some fleets, reducing the nuclear arsenal. So it's real practical, reducing active military personnel by 200,000 to 1.3 million. So it's like real, practical stuff. But, I want to take a look at some of the biggest Lego pieces. When I look at those Bush tax cuts, allowing expiration of the cuts on people above above 250,000, that saves $115 billion. But look what happens when you allow them all to expire, a huge Lego piece, $250 billion. And in considering this, what's the average that a person will get back on the Bush tax break if it stays, if they make below $250,000?
If it stays? It won't feel like they get anything, right? Because it'll just their tax rate will stay the way it is. My memory for folks below 250 is that it's somewhere north of 1% of your income. So if you're making $50,000, it'll probably, if the tax cut disappeared, which it won't, it would probably cause your taxes to go up by something like between $500 and $1,000.
So people have to weigh, $500 to $1,000, which isn't inconsequential, but they have to weigh that against, $250 billion in savings overall.
Yeah. An idea that people in Washington have started to talk about that I like is an idea that you extend the Bush tax cuts, but you do it, you say that they will become permanent for people below 250 only if we have the sort of fundamental tax reform that you and I were talking about a few minutes ago, in which you clean up the tax code, simplify it, you get rid of a lot of these deductions and loopholes, and you bring down rates. And that if Congress can't pass that, the Bush tax cuts for everyone disappear. That's kind of a nice option because the Bush tax cuts are enormous, and we can come very close to eliminating the entire medium-term deficit by letting them all lapse.
Well, you and others remind us that there was no economic growth in the decade, little economic growth in the decade following the Bush tax cuts. They didn't promote growth.
Yeah, there was some, but it was the slowest. The decade we just came out of was the slowest decade of economic growth since before World War II. And here's the really amazing statistic. Even if you throw out the Great Recession and you simply look at 2000 to 2007, it was the slowest economic growth since before World War II. So growth was really bad. Now, obviously, we don't know what would have happened in the absence of the Bush tax cuts. It is theoretically possible that growth would have been even slower without them. But I think the one thing we should be on very solid ground in saying is that the Bush tax cuts did not lead to good growth. They either did nothing for growth or their effect was too small to take us to actually having good growth.
David, I have to get at the biggest darn Lego pieces.
Yes.
Capping Medicare growth, starting in 2013, $560 billion in savings, raising the Social Security retirement age to age 70. Take Medicare first. You say capping payments to doctors and hospitals, Medicare growth, would crack down on high costs, but people are worried that it would crack down on care. And, raising Social Security age to 70, it sounds great, except will people hire people till they're 70?
Let's start with the Medicare. I actually think looking with this and playing with this has a nice lesson in it about the difference between Medicare and Social Security. As you point out, some of these Medicare options give you a lot more money than some of the Social Security options. And the reason for that is that the main fiscal problem isn't the baby boom That's the second fiscal problem. The first one is the rapid rise in costs for healthcare, which then interacts with the baby boom generation to create this huge debt bomb. But the issue is actually less that we're going to have many, many more 70-year-olds, although that's a big issue, and more that for each individual 70-year-old, healthcare is getting ever more and more expensive. And I understand that anything that cracks down on healthcare spending makes people nervous about the quality of care. But I guess the two things I would say are, one, we have no choice. We cannot afford, without massive tax increases, to let Medicare keep going as it is. And two, every other country in the world, literally every other rich country in the world, manages to provide health care for vastly less money than we do. And I understand we are a more diverse country than they are. We have more income inequality. There are all kinds of reasons to think that our healthcare system isn't the only reason that our healthcare costs are so high. But there's certainly one of them, and that suggests there's a huge amount of waste out there. There's a huge amount of medical care that isn't making people healthier. And that is the single best way we could go after our deficit.
David Leonhardt of the New York Times. We've been playing their deficit puzzle. It's on our website, hereandnow.org. You know, it really is challenging. What would you cut? Go in there and slash and then let us know. And David, as always, we thank you so much for putting this together.
Thanks for having me on and letting me talk about it.
Our pleasure. Back after the news, here and now.